This is BBC Radio 3. It's midday. Time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Naomi Alderman is a writer who likes to question established ways of thinking. In 2017, her novel The Power won the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction. It imagines a world where women develop the ability to emit electric shocks from their fingers, leading to a worldwide reversal in the traditional balance of power between the sexes. The book became a global bestseller and, more recently, a 9-part television drama. A sense of rebellion was evident in the title of her first novel, Disobedience. Its tale of a woman who questions the conventions of the strict Orthodox Jewish community in which she grew up draws in part on Naomi's own experiences. Along with 4 novels, Naomi created and has written computer games, including Zombies Run. This immersive app encourages you to improve your fitness by running faster to escape predatory zombies. Naomi, we're going to hear music by Mozart, Respighi, and Stephen Sondheim, definitely not zombies. But we're going to start by listening to somebody who people do think has a kind of mathematical element to his music, Johann Sebastian Bach. Now, this is a piece which has been like a vein running through your life, hasn't it?
It really has. This is the music when I'm feeling sorrowful, when things are tough in my life. I like to wake up to this. I've many a time set it to play on a clock radio or on my phone when I wake up in the morning. It's the Brandenburg Concerto No. 4. It feels like somebody has turned sunshine into music.
And it's sort of bubbling, isn't it?
Right, yeah. Right. It's as unarguable as a spring day. It is a reminder of the good things in the world.
And given the writing that we will talk about later, it's a wonderful marriage of the cerebral and the heart.
It is. I mean, I do love that. I'm going to say that I'm not extremely knowledgeable about music. However, I have a deep love for music and come from a very musical family. And the thing that draws me back to Bach again and again is that sense of, it's almost a promise in the orderliness that somehow if we could exist in that Bach mind space, that we can perceive the beauty, the elegance, the way that the world is fitted together. Now, I think that that's an illusion, but I would like to live in that beautiful illusion. It's as perfectly formed as a cathedral with its pillars and its vaulting. It really feels like a room one could live in.
You don't need to worry about your musicology if you can talk about music like that.
Thank you.
The suspensions and flying buttresses of the first movement of Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 4. Rinaldo Alessandrini conducted Concerto Italiano. Tell me, Naomi Alderman, you hinted that music was quite a part of your growing up.
Yes, I come from a family with quite a lot of professional musicians. My brother is a professional singer. My grandfather was a composer and a singer. I've got several cousins who work professionally in music. So I am the dunce of the family when it comes to music, which is probably why I start out by saying, please forgive me for not knowing anything. But I do certainly come from a world where learning music and learning to sing was extremely important. So I grew up an Orthodox Jew. On the Sabbath, we would be spending lots of time together as a family or a community, but you're not allowed to use musical instruments. And not only that, you're not allowed to write things down or use anything electrical. So people would get together to sing together. I get together with my family still to sing. Our voices work together in a sort of strange way that, you know, you can tell that we're family.
Your mother, Marion, was an art teacher, wasn't she? And Geoffrey, your father, a Jewish historian?
Yes, so my father is a professor of history. For many years, he was the head of academic standards at London University. My mother was a graphic designer and art teacher. She died, as we speak, about 7 weeks ago. So that is still very raw and immediate. But yes, her family is the music side of the family.
Before we hear the next piece, let's just talk about that, because it's rather appropriate for what you've just said. It's Compassion, a song cycle for voice and orchestra, arranged by Lior and Nigel Westlake. Tell me about it and why you've chosen it.
The part that I've chosen is Avinu Malkeinu, which is full of emotion. It's a song that I learned to sing, oh, I can't even remember when. I'm sure that my mother sang it to me. I'm sure that I heard it in synagogue. I know that I've sung it many times with friends and family. I have held a child on my shoulder and rocked her back to sleep singing this song. The meaning of the words is a desire to be forgiven for the things that you have done in your life that have not lived up to your highest values. But it starts at, so the words Avinu Malkeinu mean our father, our king.
So would this be an arrangement of a traditional
thing? Right, so yes, this is an arrangement of a traditional thing, but you have to imagine it sung on an afternoon with a bunch of people who have got together, none of whom are really trained professional singers.
Well, before we hear that, would you in fact just give us a little burst of it?
I would do that. Having arrived on Radio 3 saying, I don't know anything about music, now I, with a totally untrained voice, I'm going to sing to the listeners of BBC Radio 3. I hope everybody will forgive me. Avinu Malkeinu, Avinu Malkeinu, Avinu Malkeinu, Chaneinu Vaneinu, Ki ein banu masim, Aseh imanu, Tzedaka v'chesed, Aseh imanu, Tzedaka v'chesed, V'hoshienu. Thank you.
Avinu Malkeinu, Chaneinu ve'aneinu, ki ein banu ma'asim. Avinu Malkeinu, Chaneinu ve'aneinu, ki ein banu
Avinu Malkeinu, arranged by Nigel Westlake and the singer-songwriter Lior, and they performed it with the Sydney Symphony Orchestra. But I have to say, in a funny way, I actually found less is more. Hearing you do it unaccompanied, when you just have the naked sound of the single voice, there's no hiding place. And there's something particularly potent about that, I think, and I thought you did it beautifully.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. Either my voice became suited to them or they are the songs that were written by people who had a voice like mine. Mm. So, yeah, I find it very meaningful.
Naomi, you read philosophy, politics and economics at Oxford. But was it at Oxford that you realised you wanted to write?
I realised I wanted to write when I was about 7 or 8 years old. I distinctly remember coming home from school and writing a poem for my own pleasure and thinking, can I do this? Is that, you know? And then tried writing a novel when I was 15, but it was when I was at Oxford that I did actually write a full novel. It was not a good novel, but that's often the case with people's first books. And certainly that was where I met other people who also were interested in writing, and I was able to say it out loud. But, you know, it was something that I kept private for quite a long time.
You went to New York, and it was while you were there that you wrote Disobedience, which told the story of a North London rabbi's bisexual daughter, Ronit Krushka. How did that experience change how you felt about your religion?
Right, this is a very complicated question. I was living in Manhattan on 9/11. I watched the towers falling from my office window. I remember thinking in the weeks that followed, I bet there were people doing the kind of thing I was doing. I was working for a law firm. It was a perfectly fine job. It wasn't my passion. And I remember thinking, I bet there are people doing what I'm doing, which is saying to themselves, oh, well, I'll just do this job for another few years and then I'll write that novel that I always meant to write. And then that's that. Mm. So I decided, yes, I quit that job. I ended up coming back to England. I did my master's in creative writing at UEA whilst I was working on that book. And also at that time, I knew a lot of people who, you know, after 9/11, people had the feeling that they wanted to live more authentic lives. And I knew a lot of people who, I don't know, ended a relationship, decided to get married, decided to have a child, decided to move out of the city. A lot of people came out to their families. And, I mean, I am bisexual, or, you know, certainly fancy women as well as men. I think I hadn't really understood that if you were just gay and didn't have the out of being able to fit into the heterosexual world of the Orthodox community, that the Orthodox community made your life extremely tough. And I heard stories of friends who had really had terrible experiences trying to come out to a rabbi or to be accepted within the community. And I felt very worried about being part of this community that was treating some of its members so badly. And by writing the book, I expressed that. And by the end of writing the book, I realised that I wasn't going to be Orthodox anymore.
I'm rather fascinated by that conundrum, being creatively true to yourself and your religious upbringing, and also the conundrum of seeing something like 9/11, how that changes our lives. And it seems to me that there is some sort of cathartic existentialism in being able to express oneself through creativity, which opens the door to another life quite often.
Right. I think that is exactly what happened to me. I would still not say that there's nothing to recommend the Orthodox way of life. I have actually a lot of respect for it. I think it's, in many ways, a very serious, moral, thoughtful, community-based way of living. But yes, I moved in that existentialist way from a communitarian life to an individualist life. I sometimes say that I went through the Enlightenment and the individualist revolution by myself between the ages of 20 and 30. It's a strange place to still be, actually, because I can still see one thing with one eye and one thing with the other eye. And I still feel a little bit of a stranger in the modern secular world, but then I'm also a stranger in the Orthodox world, so where does that leave me?
How did your family back home react to this, and how was the novel more widely received?
My family were always supportive of me, intellectually, certainly, and supportive of my writing. The novel was less of a problem than the fact that I did stop being a practicing Orthodox Jew. I think it was difficult for my mother, actually. I think it was, but I think that we both approached it from a place of love. I wasn't doing it in a temper tantrum of adolescence, you know, wanting to hurt my parents. I was trying to live in a way that felt right to me. And we made it through. In the Orthodox community, I think there are some people who know about the book or who have seen the film who think that I hate Orthodoxy, and that is not true. But I allow them to be angry. You know, what else am I going to do? Yeah, I think there are mixed feelings, let's say that.
We're going to hear next a masterpiece, there's no question about that. It's the end of the Act Two finale of Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. But I think this probably takes you very much back to the Oxford time.
Very, very much, yes. I had a CD of The Marriage of Figaro, and I would put it on every time I was working on an essay. So the overture always means to me, sit down and write. And it is incredibly truthful about what it's like to be in conversation, in relationship with other humans. Everything is happening at the same time. There is no other way to communicate that.
Yes, and music is unique in being able to do that,
right,
isn't it?
Because
exactly. If I speak over you now, then it'll be difficult to make out what you're saying. But in music, we can do that.
Yes, how is that possible? How is it possible that you add in something, a tune, or, you know, several tunes, and then suddenly, if Shakespeare had written this and had said all the voices speak together, all you hear is cacophony. With this, you can pick out each line, but they come together. All of these people having their emotional crises all together somehow end up incredibly beautiful, which also seems a very hopeful thought about human relationships.
Oh.
Able to stop myself from conducting here as that's playing. It's so funny, is the other thing. You know, somebody constantly calling for silence. Silencio, silencio. The whole way through. And exactly what you're not going to get is silence. Everybody is in an emotional state. I'll tell you what it reminds me of. Lunch with my family, where everybody is talking over everybody else. Where there are eight conversations going on at the same time. Everybody is just pursuing their own conversation. You can join in with somebody else's, but nobody's going to stop for you. If you want to speak, you've just got to keep going with whatever the topic is that you want to have and then hope that you will win.
And it had a drive to it, doesn't it?
That's oh, my gosh. Yes, it's sort of the end. Boom, 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 boom. Feels like he's trying to make you laugh, doesn't it? He's coming to the end. The curtain is about to fall. You're supposed to be laughing at all these ridiculous characters and at the same time understanding that each of them is in a real pickle.
The end of the Act Two finale of Mozart's opera, The Marriage of Figaro. Yannick Nezet-Seguin conducting the Chamber Orchestra of Europe and a cast including Sonia Yoncheva, Luca Pisaroni, Christian Karg and Thomas Hampson. Your novel, Naomi Alderman, The Power, which came out in 2016, has recently been made into a 9-part television series. For anyone not familiar with the story, just briefly outline the plot. I'm finding it very gripping, so okay. I'm just reading it now.
I'm glad it's not too terrifying. So the novel The Power is about what happens when all of a sudden almost all the women in the world develop the power to electrocute people at will. Now, if the audience at home are having a good laugh at that thought, that is correct. It's both funny and serious, which is my favourite type of thing. What happens is the world becomes quite different. So it's a very serious thought about why and how we organise our world around the capacity to do violence. It's a serious thought about what the nature of power is and how power tends to accumulate to itself. And it's also a little bit of a fantasy visit to a world in which I could electrocute people. Yeah, why not? In the end, I took my own premise very seriously, and you can't at the end go, oh yes, I'm sure this will be fine, it'll be marvellous, women are wonderful and, you know, all loving and caring, compassionate, so it's all going to be fine. It doesn't end up so well, yeah.
It's written in the present tense, and it really invites us, the reader, to enter into the scenario, rather as Mozart does, and imagine what they would do. Now, you also create, as we've mentioned, these computer games, and I wonder if that particular skill has a crossover with your writing.
Oh, definitely. So my big game, which I'm co-creator of, is called Zombies Run, which is a running game which you play by putting in your headphones. It's on a smartphone, and we do stories of the zombie apocalypse to encourage you to go further and faster and make the whole business of getting some exercise a bit less boring. And we funded that game via the online platform Kickstarter, where people who wanted it to exist paid us the money to get the thing going. So from the start of really working in games, I was thinking about the relationship with the audience, what it is that you're promising your audience or your reader on the first page. I'm very interested in those questions. How you invite the reader to continue with you, how you leave space. I mean, The Power is a thought experiment, really, and I hope that for readers and for viewers, in the end, the question is, oh, well, how would this be different in my life?
I've always thought that the great thing of having an original idea, which allows other people to take it further, and that's what we're coming to next, because Terry Riley is thought of as the kind of father of minimalism, and particularly this piece in C. What drew you to it?
I must have first heard this about 10 years ago. I'm fascinated by the way this piece is put together. It can be played by any type of group. It's just a series of small phrases repeated by different members of the group playing together, and there's a certain rule about when you must move on from one phrase to the next, and out of that comes an infinity of music where each in C is different but each is the same. So there is something very reminiscent of computer programming, of the world of video games, of those questions of something that can be repeated and repeated and is a different experience each time and yet is the same experience each time.
Thank you.
you know what I mean? That sounds like being in time. There's something about that that for me really brings me into the exact present moment of every single note, which again is something that music does that does not exist in any other art form. That sensation of time flowing, being present with it. Okay, does that make me sound very pretentious?
No, I like the way that the people that first had these ideas, that thought this would be fascinating to listen to, gives it a kind of particular edge.
Right. It's some sort of meeting place between an analog world and a digital world. Mm. We see the digital world coming. None of us want to listen to music composed by AI, you know, but this is somehow exactly on that cusp of going, look, this is how precise, meticulous, and yet fluid and creative these things could be. I'm interested by that as well.
And you have held a candle, haven't you, for your precursors in writing science fiction, people like Margaret Cavendish?
I certainly have, yes. I mean, it's funny how these days science fiction is perhaps thought of as quite a male genre, because to me it's always been a genre where most interesting writing that was being done by women. So Margaret Cavendish writing The Blazing World, obviously Mary Shelley writing Frankenstein, which is, you know, really the opening of everything in science fiction. I love the works of Ursula Le Guin, who's a very serious sort of psychological and philosophical writer, as well as obviously a writer of great stories. And I was very fortunate to be mentored by Margaret Atwood, which has been an extraordinary life-changing experience, actually.
She changed the world in some ways with The Handmaid's Tale, don't you think?
Yes, she changed my world. Mm. I read that book when I was 16, and if you put The Handmaid's Tale together with Orthodox Judaism inside your mind, eventually something will go boom, like a sort of very long fuse. I told her that when we met, and she said, oh, I did that to you, did I? I said, yes, you did, Margaret, yeah.
You spent quite a lot of time with Margaret Atwood and her late husband, the Canadian novelist Graham Gibson. What did you do and discuss together?
Oh, gosh. We had some absolutely extraordinary trips together. I mean, Margaret and Graham died in 2019, just before the pandemic. He was just an extraordinary man. He was a naturalist. He was an ornithologist. He was most at home, I think, walking through the wild places of the world. He suffered with dementia in the last few years of his life, and yet he was always just intensely relaxed and at ease when we were in the wilderness. So I went with them to Cuba, visited the Zapata swamp in Cuba, which I believe Graham Gibson was instrumental in helping keep that a swamp and persuading Castro not to drain it and turn it into blocks of flats. We visited Panama, we went to the Arctic together.
Gosh, yes. Were they as interested in music as you are?
Very, very much so, actually. And Graham absolutely loved music. He had a huge love of everything, really, a huge love of folk music, which I share. I suppose I come from a folk music tradition, really. The idea of music with stories, music that comes from a traditional place. And in the later years of his life, when he was suffering with dementia, from what I witnessed, there was a way in which listening to music held his thoughts together, that he was able to be in the music and be himself. And the piece that we're going to listen to, the Respighi, he'd specifically introduced me to it. I heard him listening to it at sort of full blast, incredibly loud. And it was wonderful. I'd never heard it before.
So in a way, what music did for him with dementia was what Mozart did within sorting out lots of people singing together.
Right, yes. It makes everything all at once turn into one thing after another. You know, everybody knows that Margaret Atwood is just an exceptional human. And Graham was always very modest and happy for her to have the limelight, which is, you know, wonderful. And I feel like people should know that he was also an exceptional person.
Thank you.
Very life-affirming.
Oh, yes. What is it about that? That is one of those pieces of music where I feel like there's some almost nuggets of pure joy in there that immediately I finished it, I want to listen to it again.
Yes, and it's the repeated pattern which is done slightly more accented each time.
Isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Is that what's doing it?
Yeah, and I'm sure to somebody who has dementia, it's sort of saying, yes, this is it,
here you are. It's wonderful.
Bergamasker from Respighi's Ancient Airs and Dances, Henry Raudalis conducted the Munich Radio Orchestra. Now we're going to have some ballet music, Naomi, and what made you choose this?
My mother, my late mother, was a huge lifelong fan of ballet. I think had she had her life wish, she would have wanted to be a ballet dancer. She only grew to 4'10½", so that was out for her. But she loved dance. She loved dancing, and she took me to the ballet from when I was really tiny, and not just the Nutcracker. We would go to see, you know, whatever was on at Sadler's Wells. And bless her, this is an answer to the earlier question of how my family dealt with me, which is that at a certain point we went from seeing Giselle or Coppelio or something like that. My mother could see that I was heading in a more rebellious direction, so she started to take me to Mark Morris, for example, who takes the traditions of classical ballet and remixes them.
And gender too.
Right, yes, mixes up gender and sexuality. I remember two pairs of dancers, man and woman, one pair in green, the other pair in red, and you know, you expect to see they're going to dance together, and suddenly the two women go off the stage and the two men dance together. And I thought, my mother has understood something about who I am. So when my mother was dying in the Royal Free Hospital a few weeks ago, really very recently, she had had a big stroke. We knew that this was it. She lived for 8 days after that stroke. And the hospital doctors and staff said to us, well, we think that the last thing to go is hearing. Your mum's not coming back, but we think that she can still hear us. So, you know, we spent days in the hospital talking to mum and describing to her what had happened and telling her things. And one thing that I did was to play her music from favourite ballets. So my mum loved a laugh. She really enjoyed comedy with a sort of sophistication to it. She loved Frederick Ashton, whose choreography always has humour to it as well as, you know, seriousness. And so when I was sitting at her bedside, I played her the clog dance from La Fille Malgardée. La Fille Malgardée is a very old ballet. It's also connects to a very ancient repertoire.
And you could translate it, Naomi, as The Wayward Daughter.
You certainly that's very good. You could translate it, yes, as The Disobedient Daughter. But yes, my mum was always a great fan of La Fille Malgardée, and this wonderful clog dance, which is performed by a male dancer in a kind of pantomime dame type role, where the skill of it is to make it look like you have no skill. So this is a male dancer in a big dress and clogs, dancing at points, sliding across the stage. And I described to my mother what was going on. She couldn't open her eyes, but I think to myself, maybe she enjoyed, via my describing it, one last performance.
Nice way to pass to the next world.
I hope so.
Thank you. Peter Ludwig Hertel's Clog Dance, as arranged by John Lanchbury for the Royal Ballet's 1960 production of La Fille Mal Gardée. We heard Lanchbury conducting the orchestra of the Royal Opera House Covent Garden. Now, I have to tell you that a previous guest on Private Passions, Wayne Sleep, would have said to your mum, "Don't worry about being 4'10". You can really make something of it."
I think my mother would have loved Wayne Sleep to have said that to her. Yeah.
Now, you have a book coming out in the autumn?
I do. I've just finished my new novel. It's called The Future. It's about technology billionaires, and it's about a group of their assistants and ex-wives who decide to get together to take them down.
Well, we look forward to that, but we're going to play out with Stephen Sondheim. What have you chosen?
Right, this is the song Being Alive from The Musical Company, performed by Dean Jones, who was, I believe, at the point that this was recorded, breaking up with his wife, which I think comes over in the music. Because I used to be an Orthodox Jew and it took me a while to come through that, I was dating quite late in my life. I met my current partner when I was 41. And I have a number of friends who also met somebody a bit later in life. And we sometimes talk about what that experience is like. Why we're looking for this anyway? Because by the time you're 40, you've got a pretty good life. You know, you're settled and you've worked out what works for you and go, why am I doing this to myself? Why am I putting myself through these miserable dates? And a dear friend and I used to send each other lines from this song to say, what is it that we're looking for? Well, we're looking for somebody to ruin our sleep and make us aware of being alive.
A lovely note on which to say, thank you very much, Naomi Alden.
It's been an incredible joy. Thank you so much.
Someone to hold you too close. Someone to hurt you too deep. Someone to sit in your chair to ruin your sleep.
That's true, but there's more than that.
Is that all you think there is to it?
You've got so many reasons for not being with someone, but Robert, you haven't one good reason for being alone.
Come on, you're onto something, Bobby. You're onto something.
Someone to need you too much. Someone to know you too well. Someone to pull you up short, to put you through hell.
You see what you look for, you know.
You're not a kid anymore, Robbie. I don't think you'll ever be a kid again, kiddo.
Hey, buddy, don't be afraid that it won't be perfect. The only thing to be afraid of really is that it won't be.
Don't stop now. Keep going.
Someone you have to let in. Someone whose feelings you spare. Someone who, like it or not, will want you to share a little, a lot.
And what does all that mean?
Robert, how do you know so much about it when you've never been there?
It's much better living it than looking at it, Robert.
Add him up, Bobby, add him up.
Someone to crown you with love. Someone to force you to care. Someone to make you come through. Will always be there, as frightened as you of being alive. Being alive. Being alive. Being alive.
Blow out the candles, Robert, and make a wish. Want something. Want something.
Somebody hold me too close. Somebody hurt me too deep. Somebody sit in my chair and ruin my sleep and make me aware of being alive. Being alive. Somebody need me too much. Somebody know me too well. Somebody pull me up short and put me through hell and give me support for being alive. Make me alive. days, but alone is alone, not alive. Somebody crowd me with love, somebody force me to care. Somebody make me come through. I'll always be there, as frightened as you, to help us survive. Being alive, being alive, being
Being Alive from Stephen Sondheim's musical Company, performed by Dean Jones on the original Broadway cast recording. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the writer Naomi Alderman. Today's episode was produced by Claire Walker. And next week, Michael's guest will be the author of the natural history bestseller The Salt Path, Raina Wynne. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio, BBC Sounds, and on most smart speakers, just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by me, Jane Royce. The Cabinet Minister, Michael Gove, has described the behaviour of Conservative Party workers in a video showing them drinking and dancing at a Christmas celebration during the pandemic as unacceptable. The Levelling Up Secretary also apologised. The footage of staff involved in the London mayoral campaign, which was published on the Mirror's website, is believed to have been filmed in December 2020. The Conservatives say disciplinary action has already been taken against four people. Mr. Gove also said the government was looking at ways to help homeowners struggling with rising mortgage costs, but warned that money for support couldn't be magicked out of thin air. The Bank of England is widely expected to raise interest rates again on Thursday, which would be the 13th consecutive increase. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken's become the most senior member of the Biden administration to visit China. He's held talks with the Chinese Foreign Minister Qin Gang at the start of his two-day trip to Beijing, against a backdrop of strained relations between the countries. There are signs that the latest temporary ceasefire between Sudan's rival military factions appears to have brought a lull in the fighting. The 72-hour ceasefire was announced yesterday by US and Saudi mediators. Prayers have been said at church services across Nottingham this morning for the three people who were killed in knife attacks in the city last Tuesday. University students Barnaby Webber and Grace O'Malley Kumar and a school caretaker Ian Coates all died. A 31-year-old man's been charged with their murders and with the attempted murders of three people who were hit by a van. Voters in Switzerland appear to have approved measures that aim to cut the country's fossil fuel use and reach net zero emissions by 2050. Ahead of the referendum, the Swiss government said a move to renewables was needed to safeguard energy security and protect the environment. Sir Mark Rylance says when he started his career more than 40 years ago, acting used to be more accepting of what he called oddballs. He said directors understandably wanted actors who were easy to work with, but he said that could be seen as a loss. Sir Mark also said he was pleased to see that things had improved for actors from underrepresented backgrounds. The weather across England, Wales and Northern Ireland, there'll be scattered showers with some turning heavy with thunder and lightning. It'll be drier and sunnier across Scotland until this evening when it'll turn cloudy and wet. Highs of 23 Celsius in London, 22 in Cardiff, 20 in Belfast and 21 in Edinburgh. BBC News.
See every fallen wicket.
Hold him!
Hear the crack of leather on willow.
Hammer it away!
Live of the incredible moments.
Wow. There could be a run out.
Oh, my word.
The greatest rivalry in cricket.
That is outstanding.
Magnificent catch. Beautifully caught.
The Ashes first test. Watch the highlights on iPlayer. Listen live on BBC Sounds.